everyone. This is Lana, your host for the next hour. My guest is Claire, joining us from South Africa. We'll discuss what life is like for Afrikaners post-apartheid. You've all heard the lies about apartheid, and you're still hearing lies about post-apartheid. South Africa is today hailed as a rainbow nation, evoking imagery of cheerful smiles and peaceful people, but it's anything but. They claim this rainbow nation is diverse, incorporating many people. Yeah, we've been hearing that ad nauseum in the north, too. Well, no, it's just one color that matters in South Africa, and that color is black. It's funny, though, because symbolically and scientifically speaking, white is the visible expression of all color combined as light, and black is a complete absence of light and therefore color. Claire, up next. Welcome, Claire. It's great to connect with you.
Yeah, hi, Lana. Thanks so much for having me on. It's a great pleasure to be able to talk with you. I'm a huge fan, as I said.
Oh, great. Thank you. That'll be fun. Well, since you're a new voice, I think, tell us a little bit about what you do in South Africa. And I realize you can't say too much considering the current political climate down there, because you could get in trouble, negatively speaking, about the tyrants running your country. But what can you tell us about what you do down there?
Right. Okay. Well, I have a law background. I have a degree in law, and that was my initial plan, was to become an attorney, but it didn't really suit my personality. So I work at a small firm doing geographical information systems. Obviously, I was born during the apartheid era, and I was about 11 or 12 when the ANC came to power. So I've grown up in South Africa, seen it from both sides.
Yeah, the apartheid ended, let's see, in 94, so it lasted for about 50 years. I was actually in South Africa in the 90s, too. Do you remember anything from that era, or did you hear things from your parents and grandparents? Because we get so much disinfo.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I was very fortunate to go to a private school here, which was very progressive for its day. I was sort of in primary school in the 80s and early 90s. And my school was one of the first schools to admit black. It was a girls' school, and it was one of the first schools to admit black girls. So for me, it was, you know, I sort of grew up in quite a liberal kind of environment or atmosphere, but I remember apartheid very clearly, and I remember sort of being given quite a balanced view about it as I was growing up. I didn't see it as the worst thing in the world. My dad was a supporter of the National Party, so I remember how prosperous things were back then. The economy was strong, and the rand was worth about 20 times more back then than it is now.
Now, were people, they were happier, it was safer, even blacks did better, right?
Absolutely, the economy was much stronger. And yes, there was, the segregation back then was obviously a lot more marked than it is now. I remember in our neighborhoods, there were really no black or Indian people living in the neighborhood that I lived in. I had a black nanny, and made, and all the white families did back then.
It's funny to me that they do that, you know. It's just, yeah. Why?
But everybody did, and still do. I mean, it's something that hasn't really changed. It was just accepted by both races, I think, at the time. Everyone kind of, I think for the most part, normal people just accepted the way things were. And you know, it was a lot more peaceful back then, from what I recall.
Now, we get so much disinfo in the north. We hear that white people were just mass murdering blacks, but none of that is true, right?
No, it's not true at all. I mean, yes, the apartheid government had ways to deal with dissidents, and that's undeniable. People were arrested, members of the ANC were arrested and thrown into prison, and I'm sure they were dealt with harshly, but as for mass murdering, that simply didn't happen. You had things like the Sharpeville shooting, which was in 1961, if I'm not mistaken, which caused a huge outcry because it was school children that basically descended on a police station, if I'm not mistaken. They were protesting being taught in Afrikaans, and they were fired at for 30 seconds by the police. And to this day, we still have a public holiday commemorating that event because it was such a big outcry. But that sort of thing, you know, it's been very exaggerated. I think the violence of blacks on blacks was, I think, a lot more intense than white on black has been pretty minimal in comparison.
Now, when apartheid ended, what do you remember? What happened?
I was about 12 at the time, as I say, and I clearly remember the first democratic election where the entire country was sort of riding this incredibly optimistic wave. We'd seen it coming since Nelson Mandela was released from prison. And so we knew it was coming, and everyone was in really good spirits, I think, because, you know, we were very conditioned to believe that this was a good thing, and it was much to be desired and very welcome. And so when everyone turned out to vote, the whole country was in a very positive mood, I would say, and celebrations. And I think from what I remember, it was relatively peaceful. And we won the Rugby World Cup the following year, which was a very, you know, first time black players were allowed to play international rugby. And so it was a very, I would say it was an extremely optimistic time, quite short-lived, I would say, but at the time, I think the entirety of South Africa had been prepared, you know, to see it as a really good thing.
Yeah, I wonder how it went from nationalism basically to a lot of these Marxist ideas that are infecting a lot of Afrikaners, which how did that happen in such a quick period, if you know?
Exactly. And that's what I wanted to get into with you, is there was a lot of conditioning that went on. And I can see it now looking back, because I was a child and a teenager when it was happening. And as I look back, I can see how we were being primed for it by the things that were being said in the media, by the things that we were being taught at school. You know, from starting off seeing it as a really positive step for the country, it became more and more insidious, really, with the sort of influx of this extremely socialist and then Marxist and increasingly strict kind of anti-white kind of agenda that just kind of started to creep in more and more insidiously. But it was a slow, as this has been sort of 20 years or so in the making, and it's crept in gradually. I mean, I remember very clearly when I was in matric or so, sort of when I was about 16 in high school, we were learning about South African history, and we were talking about, you know, we were conditioned at the time to see Nelson Mandela as this wonderful
saint
man
and a mass murderer.
Yes, exactly, the savior who'd come to rescue our country, and no one really even questioned this because of all the you know what it's like, the emotional kind of just conditioning that you get day in and day out in the media, and you're told about how amazing this is, how miraculous this is, how we're this rainbow nation. So whether you might not fully believe it because you obviously have questions, and I was raised to be a very critical thinker, but you're willing to ride this tide as long as everything's sort of going okay. You sort of think, okay, well, maybe I can go along with this. And you know, when you ask questions, you're told, no, this is for the best, and you just need to accept it. And the sooner you accept it, the better. But I remember very clearly, as I was saying, when I was about 16 or so, we were being taught about affirmative action. It was, you know, they were very quick to bring that in. I mean, they came into power in 1994. And I would say by the late 90s, they'd already implemented affirmative action. And we were taught about affirmative action in school, and I remember my very first question, because it was the first time I'd ever heard of it, was, okay, well, if this is a measure to redress the so-called wrongs of the past, how long is it going to last? Because surely you can't have affirmative action indefinitely. If they're going to put this in as a policy, to kind of help blacks to get to where they say they're supposed to be, surely it's got to be a temporary measure.
And of course, it had to have been whites that introduced this idea, because the Africans didn't think of this on their own, right?
Yeah, well, it's Marxist policy, which, and at the ANC that came into power had been spending their time in Cuba and Russia learning Marxist ideology during the so-called apartheid struggle. So they were importing all these ideas from overseas. So I just thought, okay, well, this is just apartheid with another name, surely. To my sort of young mind, I thought, okay, well, affirmative action, okay, even if you can stretch your kind of reasoning to say that it's something which is fair, surely it's not going to always be fair. It's got to come to an end at some point. I was told that, in fact, the ANC government had no timeline on affirmative action whatsoever. To me, this seemed shocking. Even to my teenage mind, I thought this was a shocking injustice, that you can be willing to punish future generations of whites for years to come for something they didn't even do. I was a child when this all happened, and yet I was going to have to suffer the consequences of affirmative action for, with no end in sight.
Well, and that's what's happening in every white country, whether you're Swedish or Russian, it doesn't matter. You're white, you're guilty, you have to pay for transatlantic slave trade. You know, it's just ridiculous. Or colonialism, we're all implicated in it for some reason. Yeah, you were talking about it's broad-based black economic empowerment, right? God, that's a mouthful,
exactly.
The legislation.
It started off, you know, innocently enough, as I say, it started off as this very gentle kind of idea of affirmative action, and whites were acclimatized to this idea through conditioning, through the education system, through, I got it in high school, and then again when I studied at university, you got it rammed down your throats again, and gently they conditioned us to this idea of affirmative action. But it didn't stay this gentle idea of affirmative action for long. It's then, you know, it took root in various laws, and I was reading the other day, apparently there are 114 different pieces of affirmative action legislation in South Africa now.
Jeez.
So from starting off as being this kind of fair, supposedly fair policy that the ANC were introducing to redress the wrongs of the past, it then just became gradually more and more insidious, where then new legislation was passed, which actually entrenched it in law. It was no longer kind of a gentle persuasive tactic. It's now part of our law and it's not going anywhere. Then it wasn't long after that when they introduced quota systems, where the idea was that companies had to hire staff on the basis of the demographic makeup of South Africa. So South Africa being 80% black, roughly 10% white, 10% colored and Indian, their companies were told that their staff quotas had to look like that. So, after it was passed into law, quotas were introduced where companies had to submit reports as to how many people of different races they were employing.
Ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
In America, you have to employ minorities. They have all these special privileges here, whereas in South Africa, the majority has the special privileges, right?
Well, exactly. I mean, you wouldn't introduce something to protect the majority if you didn't believe that the majority could make it on their own. That's obvious.
Yeah.
If the majority could get hired on their own merits, you wouldn't need these incredibly far-reaching laws. So from the quota system, it quickly moved, well, over a period of time, the government was constantly, over a period of years, has been saying that hasn't been doing enough.
Oh, jeez. So are there black-only companies, and do they have to meet diversity quotas too?
No. It doesn't work the other way around. So that double standard is never questioned by the government. Black-only companies are certainly not pressured to hire white employees. It really only applies where you have companies that were traditionally mostly white that are being pressured not only to hire in their new hiring to hire black employees, but actually to we went through a long period of time where skilled white workers, and my mom was one of them, were retrenched to make way for new black employees. So that happened for quite a long time. It wasn't enough just to hold on to your job. White employees were actually retrenched and fired so that companies could make up their quotas. But certainly no, black companies, only black companies are held up as paragon. They're definitely not required to hire white people.
Well, then why would those people have a problem with apartheid if they want to be separate anyway? It just seems like they just want to have whites around to kind of toy with them and tantalize them, or maybe make them work for them, kind of be slaves for them, but they don't want them to really separate and do their own thing, right?
Well, this is it. You notice that blacks want to have a piece of the white pie, but it doesn't work the other way around. For the most part, I think white people, if left to their own devices, do tend to stick together. I work for a company that has an unspoken policy of just hiring white people. So does my boyfriend. And I think that's how whites have been able to survive, really, in this new climate, is by sticking together. And white neighborhoods tend to stay white. And even if they don't explicitly exclude other races because they can't, I think they, in practical ways, we come together. So I think for the most part, you know, people are not really interested in mixing, except where the government forces it to happen. You know, where government has forced big companies to hire, you know, many people of different races. For the most part, people are happier when they are with their own kind.
Now, is it easy for whites to start a business on their own, or is it tough to get loans, or do they need government approval? What's that process like? Because I know in places like Fiji, for instance, if a foreigner wants to start a business, they have to go into business with a Fijian in order to start the business.
Oh, gosh. It's not easy. The slow economic growth has made starting a business pretty difficult for just about anybody, and a lot of white people not being able to get access to the job market, I think have tried to start their own businesses, but it's difficult because of the slow economic growth rate, and also the government has implemented pretty burdensome legislation for small businesses, where they have to meet so many administrative and requirements. That it's difficult to get a business off the ground, and banks in this country are also very gun shy about giving loans out. Certainly, if you don't have money behind you, which many whites just simply don't anymore, it's not easy to start a business here. No.
Now, what is your media like down there? Is it as controlled as we have up here in the North? I mean, are they also blasting Black Lives Matter propaganda and showing,
yes,
when, in America, blacks are, shot by cops? Do they show that?
Absolutely. I would say, I mean, I can't speak for exactly what the media is like in America and Europe. I've kind of had a taste for it, of what I've gone looking for on the internet. But I would say it's probably a lot worse here, because they've got such a ready scapegoat with apartheid. Just for the longest time.
It's like the Holocaust card, the apartheid card, You can do anything because of the apartheid.
Yeah. I would say it's a lot worse over here. You not only have you got this sort of ready-made scapegoat in the form of apartheid, which people have been amazingly willing to swallow. There's no end to the number of things that have been blamed on apartheid. Most recently, we've had the protesters destroying the universities, And obviously that's been blamed on apartheid too. They don't want the sort of white institutions that we set up for them during apartheid. They want free education and they don't want to pay fees, and they don't like the Eurocentric nature of our education. And so there's no end to the number of ways you can spin apartheid being to blame for things. So the media is, I think, taking the sort of stance that when in doubt, rather be sympathetic to those blaming apartheid. So people have been very reluctant to come out and say, well, you know, actually apartheid isn't to blame for everything. Not all white people are racist. The media have been very reluctant to sort of take a realistic stance on things, because you've had the occasional person who's popped their head up and sort of spoken out about the things that are going on, and they've had pretty horrific consequences when they've done that. People have lost their jobs. That's usually the first thing that happens when you say something that sounds like it's sort of criticizing the apartheid is to blame for all things party line. People have been found guilty of hate speech, to pay horrific fines. The fear.
Do they spend any time in jail for quote unquote hate speech or racism? What happens to them? What's some of the worst things that can happen to them other than being fired and fined? They could be killed, right?
I don't know of anyone who's actually been killed as a result. I don't know of anyone who's actually spent time in jail for hate speech. But certainly, I know of one lady who was given a 150,000 rand fine for something she said on Facebook. Another guy was also given a massive fine. They had to do community service, which I suppose it doesn't sound that bad, but when you take it in the context of losing your job on top of that, and jobs are hard to come by in South Africa these days, it's enough to make people self-censor pretty heavily, I would say. You've got to be very careful of the things that you say.
Yeah, like Penny Sparrow, right? She mentioned something about black people on the beaches. They were, what'd you say, behaving like monkeys. They were littering everywhere.
Yeah.
Not picking up their trash. And yeah. She got in big trouble, didn't she?
She had the audacity to mention this, which is something that everybody knows. All white people know this. This has been happening since I was a child, you know, for as long as I can remember. You don't go to the beaches on New Year's Day because it's a massive black mass of people. And the beaches are in a total state afterwards. And she mentioned this on Facebook, and she used the unfortunate word monkey, but she was referring to the fact that a monkey will, and we have monkeys over here, they'll pick something up, they'll take one bite and they'll throw it on the ground. And that's what she meant by the comments. I don't think I certainly wouldn't regard that as hate speech, but she was absolutely plagued with death threats after that came out. She was found guilty in court of hate speech. She was fined 150,000 rand. And her life will never be the same again. She was absolutely vilified in the media.
Jeez.
It was actually very sad to watch, because I really don't think that she meant it in a particularly mean-spirited way. I think she was referring to the fact that she was disgraced by the fact that her own beaches, you know, were a pigsty, which we all
are. Of course, you should be mad about that.
Absolutely, it's how we all feel. But just because she said it, she was turned into a villain. And so many white people jumped on the bandwagon and said, oh, you know, it's terrible that she said these things. But it's things that they say in private, and she said it publicly. So, yeah.
So would you say the majority of Afrikaners are liberal these days, or where do they fall on the political spectrum then?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that they're liberal. I would say they've been neutered, to be honest. I think they feel very despondent. I think they see their culture and their heritage slipping away from them. The universities that used to teach in Afrikaans are not allowed to do that anymore. Afrikaans is not really a language that's being encouraged to be spoken. There's so much shame attached to being an Afrikaner, and they're not encouraged to preserve their heritage. It's quite difficult in the current climate. So I would say I wouldn't go so far as to say that they're liberals, because I think they're pretty right wing in their hearts. They love, you know, the Afrikaner culture goes back so far. They love their culture, they love their people, they love their history. They're not really ashamed, but they've been made to feel so much shame that I think they don't really know which way is up anymore. They're very confused, and you just don't hear from them so much anymore. I think when they're called upon to say something, they'll try give the most liberal answer that they can. They'll tell you apartheid was a terrible thing, and they'll sort of protest that they're not racist. But I think
it's like that here too. I think a lot of white people in Europe and America, Australia, New Zealand, in the colonies, I think they're really nationalists in their heart, but they're not brave enough to come out and say it because of all the social repercussions that happen. Even here with Trump supporters, you know, I try and coax it out of people, and the only way I can do it is like, hey, I'm voting for Trump. And then they say, oh yeah, okay, oh, I'm voting for Trump too. It's like, there's a shame to admit that, you know, they're worried about what might happen.
That's exactly it. It's like they believe the things that we're speaking about in their hearts, but it's that exactly. They're just so terrified of being ostracized and of something negative happening to them, that they don't want to be the first one to sort of come out in support of any kind of anything that even smells like a right wing idea.
Now, how do whites view the white squatter camps? Do they ignore it? Do they resent them? Do they think they're trashy? Or what's their stance on the destitute, you know, whites in poverty?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I think white people in this country are just incredibly saddened by it. We sympathize. I don't think there's a single white person in this country who hasn't been affected somehow by the new regime, and so I think we have a great deal of sympathy for the whites that have been incredibly hard hit, lost their jobs, lost their livelihood. I think we'd love to do more to help, but so many of us are just simply trying to survive, you know, ourselves. But yeah, there's no question that we know how hard this has been on our own people, and I think it saddens other white South Africans tremendously. As I say, we've all been hit in one way or another by loss of. We've all had people who've lost their jobs.
And from what I've seen too, it seems like the rich white people that are down there are they're members of another tribe, if I put it that way, but they're also more Marxist, so they really don't give a damn about poor white people anyway.
Yeah, I think it's become very fashionable to support black charities rather than white charities. I think there's a sort of a feeling that, white people will kind of be okay no matter what, and it's just kind of more, it's not very fashionable to come out in public and support white-only charities. It's a lot more fashionable to be seen to be siding with poor black people. That's honestly just that I've seen that in my own friends and in the people around me.
People think, oh, they have privilege, they'll come out of it okay, even though they're living in the dirt, right? Oh, they're privileged, they'll figure it out, they're white, they'll figure it out. Well, then that's saying that we're different.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the irony of it, is that people know that we're different. Everybody, race is a reality that everybody knows about. But as for actually coming out and doing anything practical about it, that's where people are, they've just been so conditioned over the course of their life to be terrified of doing anything which seems to support white people. And I know as much as, you know, I agree with the sort of things that you guys are saying, for the most part, it's difficult to come out and say, well, you know, I want to only support my own kind, or I want to uplift other white people before. I mean, that I think in practice, that's how a lot of us, as I was saying, that's how a lot of us live our lives. Where we can, we'll give a job to a deserving white person. But as for coming out publicly and saying that's what we're doing, I think people like to look as if they're liberal, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think maybe down there, maybe right now is not the smartest time. I mean, there's a lot of alt-right people up in Europe and America that stay anonymous, but I think things will change as it becomes more popular and as we become more of a bigger group and a force to be reckoned with. People will have some courage to come out, if you know
Absolutely.
What I mean. Well, there is also a group I want to ask you about. You told me it was called Solidarity, you would say in English,
yes.
down
yes.
in South Africa. What are they doing? Because they also submitted a report to the UN, right?
Yes, I found that so interesting. This is something I only discovered a few days ago. It's a Solidaritate, is the South the Afrikaans word at least, and it means solidarity. They've been putting up ads on YouTube where it's a group that have seen what's going on. They've seen how white youngsters are being refused admission to university because of quotas, how white youngsters are not getting jobs. They've sort of seen the plight of specifically Afrikaans white youngsters, but just white youngsters in general. And they've sort of thought, okay, well, they want to do something to uplift specifically white young people. And they've set up education funds and to, you know, so that to enable deserving white youngsters to go to university and to start businesses and that sort of thing. It is specifically for white people. They submitted a report to the United Nations, and there was a committee that the United Nations formed that actually called a delegation from the South African government to address the points that were raised in this report that Solidaritate submitted to them. And the UN committee findings on the South African government's policies were absolutely damning. They were, you know, they found them to be racist in the extreme, what they're doing to white people. Because the policies of the South African government and what the UN said is that they're based purely on your race. The barriers to the job market have got nothing to do with your poverty status or how deserving you are in terms of your economic level. It's pure barrier based on race, and the UN sort of called the South African government to answer on how, you know, to justify their policies. And
I didn't hear anything about this. There are no media attention. So what came out of this? It's amazing that the UN is even acknowledging this, because a lot of people have been using the word genocide down in South Africa and talking about all the murders, but nothing ever comes of it.
Well, this is exactly it. This just goes to show you how much this has been suppressed in the media. I certainly hadn't heard about it until I specifically Googled Solidaritate, because I was looking for information on them. And it turned out that they compiled the shadow reports with figures of the rising poverty amongst whites in South Africa. And they'd gone and documented the affirmative action laws and the effects of affirmative action in detail and the effects that it was having on the white population. And they'd submitted this shadow report, and the UN were shocked. And as I say, they called the South African government to account for it. Whether anything will actually come of it or be done about it, I'm not sure. But I was just amazed that this didn't find its way into the mainstream media. in fact, these sort of statistics are hidden from us. It's hard to find unless you actually go looking for us.
Well, the UN should be releasing a press release, but I guess they didn't do that when it came to this report.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like us, no.
Now, what's the latest news with the attack on the farmers and the attempts to redistribute the land? I don't hear much about that anymore.
No, I think, again, that's a prime example of where this is being kept out of the news. All that we really know as South African consumers is that food, as a result, you know, coming from farms, is just getting more and more expensive because it's the production levels are dropping as farms are being taken away from productive white farmers and redistributed to black farmers. The production levels at those sorts of farms typically drops dramatically, causing food shortages, which, you know, causes the price of everything to rise. In terms of farm murders, I haven't heard too much about that in the news recently. These things tend to come in waves, and it seems like when there are a few, it seems to give a whole lot of these sort of rather violent farm laborers the idea to do it. So you get these crime waves where it kind of sweeps through a particular area and lots of farms get hard hit at once.
Yeah, they get a pack mentality, or as they say in America, chimp outs.
Absolutely.
Right? And then just go.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got farms that are close together where the farmers are being murdered. Then it seems to go quiet for a while. But how many of these are actually being reported and actually making their way into the news? I'm not sure. What I do know is those farmers that I know of, their outlook is pretty bleak. They're either embroiled in land claims where you've got blacks that are laying claim to their land, or they've just got such heavy security on the farms. You know, generally, they are terrified of being attacked.
Yeah, what do you think of all these claims? You know, they stole the land, because we know that I've talked to enough South Africans to learn a bit of history down there. There was nothing when European
exactly.
settlers arrived.
Well, it's completely false. I learned today actually that the Zulus sort of actually came down into a lot of the territories at this around about the same time the Dutch did. So the indigenous people that were living here were certainly not the same black people that we have today, who are mostly Zulus. The Zulus were not here when white people came to South Africa 300 or so years ago. So the idea that we stole the land from them is just blatantly false. The Zulus wiped out the local blacks that were here, who were not Zulu and are practically extinct now. So if anything, the Zulus should actually be paying reparations and giving the land back to those kind of remaining bushmen who were actually here before them. But it's definitely not the case that sort of droves of white people came and chased them off the land. It's just not true.
Yeah, people always have this romantic idea that it was just all peace and they were all just holding hands before the white man arrived, right? It's like, no, they were killing each other, you know. There was plenty of war going on.
Very violent, aggressive people. And there was a great sort of deal of battling going on when white people arrived here. And certainly the Zulus of today bear no resemblance to, or the sort of link to their past is so tenuous that to say they have more of a right to the land than some farmer who's been farming it productively for the last several generations, it's crazy. But this is the sort of logic that we are kind of living with these days.
So do they also, in the universities there, do they also push, you know, all these lies about slavery and colonialism? Do you get the same kind of garbage down there?
Oh, yes.
As we get up here?
Absolutely. Universities are very liberal. They have to be. I remember when I was studying law, I had it sort of pushed down my throat that, you know, all these sort of liberal lies that we get told about how land is a right, just like food and water. So everyone has a right to land, whether they've worked for it or not. And that how people only, black people only commit crime because they're poor. You're taught about apartheid and virtually nothing else. You're certainly not taught about your own heritage. I learned more than I could ever wish to about the apartheid governments and about the struggle, you know, to free us from apartheid. But I learned very little about the history of my own people. We didn't sort of learn much about, you know, our sort of ancestors who came to South Africa, the Dutch who settled here, and any of that sort of information. It's just it's everything is clouded by this agenda where we kind of have to. It all kind of seems to be wanting to bring us to a point where we kind of accept that we have this tainted past, and now we have to accept that we're this rainbow nation. And everything in the education system, I would say, is sort of geared towards bringing you to that sort of acceptance.
Now, are they pushing the same kind of lines of, oh, we need to all just mix ourselves out for peace and just be one race and then we'll all get along? Do you hear some of that down there?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's, I would say I see it the most in terms of kind of living arrangements. The apartheid government was pretty effective in dividing the different races up into different areas. What we have is a situation now where black people are moving into white neighborhoods. Obviously, it's not happening the other way around. White people are not moving into black neighborhoods. But you typically have, you know, some blacks living in white neighborhoods. And it doesn't work because culturally we are just so very different. For example, the Zulus will celebrate a wedding by slaughtering a goat, and they will have these sorts of celebrations in their back garden, right next to someone like myself who's very white, very culturally English, and the two cultures are just completely diametrically opposed.
Yeah, you're like having your tea and biscuits while your neighbor's slaughtering a goat. Yeah, that doesn't work.
Exactly. And you have, they're a very like loud and gregarious sort of people, and they play their music extremely loud, and that's just not how we are. They'll cram way more people into a house than, yeah, than the house can actually hold, and you've got these two living side by side, and to draw any attention to that, the fact that it makes us uncomfortable, is supposedly racist. I mean, I own a flat in a block of flats, and I lived there for a little bit. I don't live there anymore. I rented out, but I lived there for a bit, and there was a black family living in the same block of flats, and the unit that they had was only allowed to have two adults and two children, but they had about four children living in a very in one room, really, and these children would just cry and scream and make a huge noise, and I went to them and tried to very nicely talk to them about it, and you know, kind of raise my concern, and I was roundly told, just for having the audacity to talk to them about it, I was told that I was racist, and yeah. So
it's funny because something like that just happened here in America, and it makes the news. Apparently some happened to be white guy and his neighbor happened to be black, who was making lots of noise at night. It was like 3 a.m. He goes and leaves a note on his door. You know, you're being a rude neighbor. Please keep it quiet. My wife and I have to get up early to sleep. Well, this guy ran to the press with it and said that this some racist white guy was attacking him, and this is what gentrification sounds like. So basically, silence, asking for silence and peace and quiet is becoming racist, you know?
Yeah, this is it exactly. No one has any sympathy when you try to kind of approach this reasonably and say, well, you know, culturally, this is just not how we do things. The second that you kind of suggest that they should maybe amend their behavior to be a bit more considerate to their neighbors, you're branded a racist because you can't draw attention. I was told in that same block of flats, I was told, well, black people just speak loudly and they shout, and that I need to get used to that.
Just so accept it, right?
Just accept it. You can be on the other side of the road and hear a black person having a conversation, but the same is not true for white people. White people speak quietly, and they're generally quiet in their ways over here. So apparently, just for wanting that sort of level of quietness around you, that is regarded as racist over here.
Yeah, isn't it interesting? It's always in every white country, it's always white people that have to give something up or surrender something. It's never the other way around. It's never people respecting us in our ways. It's always us having to give up more and more and more all the time.
Yeah, that's it exactly. We're the ones who've got to understand. We're the ones who've got to make allowances. But they don't ever show any willingness to make allowances for the way we are. Our quiet way of life, they don't have much respect for that. So it saddens me. We're pushed, like you say, this kind of multicultural sort of diversity where we all have to live together, although no one is really happy with it. It doesn't work. It doesn't work.
It's because it's forced. If it's organic and people move together, that's one thing. But this is not. This is government forcing people to live with each other. I mean, that just doesn't work. You can't force people to do it. If they think it was wrong to force people apart, why is it right, all of a sudden, morally right to force people together?
Yeah.
Why do they think this is morally, that they're the ones that are right in this matter?
Yeah. I think it's because they have kind of become the new writers of the moral code. Where they kind of decide you're a good person if you put up with, you know, a culture that's foreign to you, and you're a bad person if you don't like it. So you're a good person if you accept that your universities are being burned to the ground, and you're a bad person if you kind of say, well, this is outrageous, and black people should not be allowed to burn the very universities that my ancestors worked very hard to build for them. I don't get how you can have the moral high ground when you're doing things that are just blatantly wrong. You know, it saddens me a great deal. I don't mind telling you.
Well, it's up to people like us to not accept it, to fight back and to say, actually, no, you're wrong. And what you're doing is totally evil and hateful, instead of just putting up with it and being quiet and going away.
Yeah. And this is what I've been trying to say to people as much as I can. Anyone that I talk to about it, I do try to say, well, you know, it's not virtuous to keep quiet in the name of trying not to seem racist. You do have to call out things that are just blatantly wrong. Crime is wrong. Destroying universities is wrong. I'm not going to keep quiet about that and say, well, I'm going to try and be sympathetic and try and understand, just simply because the people that are behaving the way are black. I'm not prepared to do it, and I do quite as much as can. Although people are still afraid to. They're afraid to come out and kind of say it. But I agree. That's part of the reason I'm doing this interview with you, is because I do think we have an obligation to
come. Yeah, we have to think about the future of our kids. Otherwise, they're going to be like, well, what did you do, mommy and daddy? I stayed quiet. I watched it happen and I said nothing. I mean, what's noble and virtuous about that, right? What's brave and courageous about that? That's not the ways of our ancient ancestors.
No, not at all. We need to grow a bit of backbone here, I think. It's about time that we did.
Well, I know you also wanted to talk about social media and how it's being used for witch hunts to hunt down people who speak and think like we do. So what would you like to say about that?
Yeah, there were quite a few people that I thought warranted a bit of a mention, because I just found it so disgraceful. They were witch hunted, really. I spoke about Penny Sparrow and what she said about the beaches. And there was a DJ who, he didn't even come out and support what she'd said. He simply made a comment about free speech and that the way people had vilified her wasn't in keeping with free speech. And simply for saying that on social media, he lost his job and was called a racist. Simply for trying to stand up for this woman's right to free speech. He didn't even say he supported what she said. He just simply said he believed that she had the right to say it, really. I don't think he was even as direct as that. So that's how bad it's become. There were a few other examples that I mentioned to you. Chris Hart was an investment banker with Standard Bank, and he made a comment about how the number of victims since the end of apartheid has simply increased, along with the sense of entitlement and hatred towards minorities. And for saying that, not even mentioning black people, but just simply talking about the sense of entitlement, he was suspended from his job as well. There was a high court judge, I found this very interesting. She talked about rape culture.
Mabel, right? Jansen?
Mabel Jansen.
Yeah, I remember that.
She's a high court judge, so if anyone should know what she's talking about, it would be her. She's the one who actually has to adjudicate these sorts of cases. They actually come before her. She's the one that has to hear the details of all these child rape cases. And, I mean, South Africa has got, if not the highest, then one of the highest rape rates in the world. And you cannot get away from the fact that this is Zulu culture has got to be to blame for part of this, because the majority of our population is Zulu. So you have to talk about the cultural aspects of this. And she did that. She was simply trying to bring attention to the cultural aspects of rape. And I mean, it must be very harrowing as a judge to have to see hear about the details of these cases day in and day out. And she was absolutely condemned in the media as being the worst kind of racist.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. I mean, she's a judge. She hears and sees and knows it's the truth. But no, you can't say what's in front of your face. You can't say the truth. I mean, this is leftist totalitarianism. This is what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I thought was interesting was that she didn't even seem so concerned about, the consequences to herself. What she was concerned about was that instead of spending all this energy in labeling her as a racist, the country should address the issue of protecting women and children. That's where she made the point. That's where your energy should be going. Why are you so concerned about outing me as a racist when I'm drawing attention to a much bigger issue? And that was what was for me shocking.
Yeah, all the feminists are quiet all of a sudden, right?
Yeah, it's on the issue of race. It's like it trumps every other issue. People can be raped. Children can be raped. Babies can be raped. But let you mention one thing about it being a black cultural problem, and you're the bad person. And she's a judge who's put many of these rapists away. And yet she was the one that was vilified. I thought it was horrific. I really did. But she's not the only one who's, as I say, these aren't the only people who've been vilified in the social media. I could go on and on. Another one I wanted to mention, just because he has ties to Solidarité, which is that organization I spoke about earlier, was Steve Hofmeyr, who's a South African singer. He's pretty well known. And he has, his reputation has virtually been shot to hell. He's been kind of stereotyped as the worst racist you can get, just simply for being an Afrikaans nationalist and for coming out and saying that he's an Afrikaans nationalist. And for saying, I think the comment that he made was that he's yet to meet a white person who would rape a black person.
Yeah, it just doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen, and it's truthful. It's not racist to say that, because it's truthful. It doesn't
exactly.
White on black crime is virtually non-existent. And he said, he, as far as he can see, you don't have white kids climbing over fences of black people's houses to go in and threaten them. It just doesn't happen. But yeah, he's been now. I read, aside from being branded a terrible racist in the media, he's been prevented from performing at many venues for saying these things.
What's his name again, so we can help support him and check out his music?
Oh, Steve Hofmeyr. He's come out and said that he doesn't have anything against black people. What he's for really is the preservation of his own culture.
Exactly. That's what all nationalists are about. You know, we're actually about preserving human biodiversity, not about mixing it all up and blending it all into the same nothingness.
Yeah. And I, you know, when I read some of the things that he says, I feel for him, and I'm half Afrikaans. So a part of me kind of like really sort of feels this yearning as well for a culture that's dying out. And I read one article, which is written by a black person who interviewed him, and where Steve was talking about, you know, his heritage and how he's trying to preserve the Afrikaans language and culture. And this black journalist who was interviewing him called him a dodo, as in, you know, something which is going extinct. And I thought that was so telling. You know, we talk about cultures going extinct, European cultures that are going extinct. And it was said in such a mocking tone, like, well, he must just, the Afrikaans people must just kind of sit back and await their own demise, because they're about to go extinct. And I thought that was really, you know, terrible.
Yeah, I mean, they just openly hate us, these anti-whites, and rejoice and push for our extinction. And that's not hateful? That's not racist? I mean, you have to be blind to not see how hateful and racist that is.
Well, exactly. I mean, what kind of a person kind of looks at someone who's trying to preserve their heritage and culture, not actually harming anyone else in the process, and kind of calls them a dodo who's about to become extinct, and kind of sort of chuckles to themselves as if to say, oh, you know, you poor deluded Afrikaans person, you don't realize how obsolete you're becoming. And of course it's hateful. It's disgusting. It makes me ashamed to be African now. I was always so proud to be South African, but I don't feel proud these days. I'm proud to be part of my, you know, part of my own culture, but when a group such, and Afrikaans is a legitimate culture and it's on its own, and when they want to stand up and sort of have a bit of pride in their heritage and their history, and they're told that they can't, I mean, it's unjust. It's a shocking injustice, as far as I'm
It is,
concerned.
But at the end of the day, they're going to have the willpower and the drive and the fight to want to survive and continue on. I mean, if they don't have that, then I'm sorry, you're not going to continue. It's the sad truth, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. It's very sad, but you're absolutely right. No one is going to save them if they won't save themselves. And that's true for all of us.
Well, Claire, I want to thank you for your time today. It's been a really interesting, eye-opening hour. So thank you so much. I know it's tough to come on and talk about some of these things
because
you can get in trouble, but I really appreciate it.
No, it's been absolutely fantastic, Lana. Thanks so much for having me.
Remember to check out the Radio 314 archives and search for all my shows about South Africa if you want to hear more about South Africa. And be sure to watch our YouTube channel as we have two live streams next week. We're covering the final presidential debate on Wednesday the 19th with special guests. And on Monday, we have a surprise live stream. Visit redice.tv for all our content. And if you sign up for a Red Ice membership, you'll have access to all our shows, including our weekend live show, Weekend Warrior, available only for members. And if you haven't already, get a Red Ice t-shirt for men and women made with organic cotton by yours truly. Next week, I'll be back with an interesting show on how the gods have fled. What did Nietzsche mean by God is dead? Lots to tune into next week. Have a good night.
Lady blow for non-sir here, mon. Lady dictator for non-sir. Wouldn't give a Baptist body kranse antwoord geer. Hier ons verlate vlakkes, hy kreeg van onze waan. Rust die stem van ons geliefde, van ons land Zuid-Afrika. Ons sal antwoord op jou roepstem, ons sal offer wat jy vraag. Ons sal lewe. Say that.